Welcome to the Concordia Publishing House podcast, where we consider everything in the light of Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. I'm your host, Elizabeth Pittman. Today we're joined by Dr. Jim Veltz. Dr. Veltz is the author of two volumes of the Concordia Commentary series on the Book of Mark. As we chat today, Dr. Veltz is going to share with us an overview of Mark, some of the linguistic themes and the grammatical things that make Mark unique, as well as an overview of the plot and some of the main characters and why this book is so important for us today. But before we get started, I'd like to thank our friends at the LCMS Foundation for their support of the CPH podcast. How can your congregation turn significant financial gifts into a long-term funding source that blesses your congregation for years to come? The LCMS Foundation was created to do just that by providing professional investment services to LCMS churches, schools, and RSOs. They've helped hundreds of congregations create, manage, and grow their endowments using investments that are tailored to each congregation's unique goals and needs. And they'd like to help yours. Learn more at lcmsfoundation.org/podcast. Now on to our conversation with Dr. Jim Veltz. Dr. Veltz, it's good to see you today.
It's good to be seen.
Well, you are our first episode of the new year, 2024, and so I'm excited to have you visit with us to talk about the Book of Mark. Recently, we were able to talk at the Society of Biblical Literature, where you were presenting a number of sessions about Mark. Tell us a little bit about your experience this past year at SBL and how Mark is being received there and in the academic community.
Excellent questions. First of all, just for the viewers and the listeners, the Society of Biblical Literature is a North American-based society of people working with the Bible and related literature. And we have an annual meeting that moves around each year. So this time we were in San Antonio. Last year, we were in Denver, and next year, we'll meet in San Diego. It meets in conjunction with the American Academy of Religion, which would comprise basically people working with world religions, also Christianity, but, you know, there's Judaism, Islam, and so on. And the two meet together, and together, at least before COVID, this meeting drew 10,000 people. So now post-COVID, it's down a bit, but it's coming back. I mean, my guess is it was 8,000, maybe something like that. And you were there and you got to experience the book area, which is really interesting. All of these publishers from all around the world, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard University Press, Fortress, and Concordia Publishing House. And I want to thank you personally for being there, because it's important that Concordia Publishing House actually have a presence at something like this, because literally there are thousands of people there, thousands of people. Do you have any idea personally how many stopped by the booth to talk to you?
A lot. And it was neat to, if you're a book lover, the book area, the book exhibits at SBL are just a wonderful, wonderful place to be, because you have all sorts of books to look at and experience. I couldn't give you an exact number, but we had a lot of people who definitely came by and thanked us for being there, and we're really glad. I had some folks come up saying, I'm a Lutheran from Texas, and we're glad to see you. And so it was a great experience.
Yeah, great. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you know this, and this surprised me when I asked, that the vast majority of people at this conference are actually from the American Academy of Religion, not the SBL. But the vast majority of people buying books are from Society of Biblical Literature. So this is why the booksellers really want to have the Bible people there. Well, I have been involved with several groups at SBL. Principally in recent years, the Mark group. Now, actually, the Mark group right now is split into two groups. There is the thing called the section of the gospel according to Mark. And I'll talk about the program on that in a minute. But then the other one is called Mark Passion Narrative. And this is a seminar. Now, there's a difference with the way this thing is organized at SBL. Seminars are groups of people who have agreed to work together, and we pass papers around to each other to read. big papers, 20, 30 page papers. Then when we meet together, like, for example, in San Antonio, the papers are not read. The person just gives like a 10-minute precy, and then we have a discussion. And basically, we sit around in kind of a big horseshoe or something like that for the people of the seminar to discuss. Now, I presented a paper there, and the theme was the ending of Mark, the ending of Mark. And so with that, we were dealing with the last chapter and issues regarding the ending. Now, almost everybody watching this podcast is going to know about this, that recent translations end the Gospel of Mark at 16:8 with the Mark saying about the women, "For they were afraid." And the King James goes on for another 12 verses, which talks about Jesus appearing to disciples, Mary Magdalene first, to the disciples, and the ascension, and so forth. Now, so I presented a paper there, which was actually based upon my work in the Concordia Commentary series. And this is it. It's the, hold up that second. That's the one right there. Yeah. So what I did was I drew material from Excursus 19, which talks about the long ending, but then I folded in material from the commentary itself on verse 16:8. So the paper is kind of good in the sense that it draws together material from two different places in the commentary, and that was sort of helpful. So let me just talk about the theme of that. I basically asked, well, should we really consider the long ending once again? You know, that the King James, what they did was actually right, as opposed to what modern translations are doing, or where I myself ended my writing of the commentary at 16:8. Now, other people were giving some things on the same kind of topic and so forth. So after we give these, we have this big discussion that ensues, which is really good. Now, we can come back to that, Elizabeth, but right now I want to talk about the main Mark section. Now, the main Mark section it's called a section, and in this, there are public presentations of papers, generally of 20 to 25 minutes. So they try to do it with the discussion in a half hour. Now, there were actually, this was really very interesting how this all went. The Mark section actually has three different times that it meets and three different topics. So there's always kind of a free section where people can just submit papers. So if any of the listeners or viewers here, are interested in going to Society of Biblical Literature and presenting something like, say, on Mark, then there'll be a call for papers that will go out in the spring. And then the steering committee for the section selects six papers because it's a three hour time block. In that, the three we had this year, we had this open section where people could just give papers. Then we had another interesting joint section. I just want to say a word about this, at which my colleague David Maxwell from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, made a presentation. Now, David Maxwell is not an exegete. He is a historian, systematician kind of guy. And he gave a paper, because this was the topic, the reception of Mark in the early church. Because Mark, being the shortest of the Gospels, didn't get a huge amount of play in the early church. There aren't a lot of commentaries written on just the Gospel of Mark, okay? And yet, the Gospel of Mark has always been part of the fourfold Gospels right from the second century onward. And he gave a paper on the Gospel of Mark in Egypt. So in Egypt, meaning, you know, around Alexandria, which was a huge, Alexandria was the huge intellectual center of the Greco-Roman world. I mean, there were three great universities at Alexandria, at Athens, and at Tarsus, where Paul comes from. But Alexandria was the basis, and Alexandria was the place where the great library of Alexandria was located, the library which contained at its height all of the originals or first editions of all of the writings of the Greek world. And that's why when that library burned as a result of some warfare and so on, I mean, it's one of the great and tragic losses in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but anyway, David presented a paper that was extremely interesting on how Mark survived around in Egypt, because there's a tradition of Mark and Alexandria and Egypt of being there and his disciples being there and so forth. So it made a great impact, and I was very happy for David and for our seminary that, you know, that essentially, well, what would you say? Well, he was able to give a great accounting, you know, of himself for this. But then there was the third offering of this section, and I gave a paper there. And here's what it was. I'm on the steering committee of both of these, the Mark Passion Narrative Seminar and the Mark section. And we determined last year that we were going to start to do some holistic reading of Mark. So in other words, not just a paper on, let's say, the baptism of Jesus or the crucifixion of Jesus, but to have papers that started to see how does a given author put things together completely. So what we did is we determined that the first year, it's going to be multi-year. The first year was going to be the introduction, however far you thought that went, and what it is that you thought was key to the introduction relative to the sweep of the whole story of Mark. So I presented a paper on that, and now you're able to hold up the other volume of, there you go, yes, you know, basically taking materials out of there. And I contend against most other people that the introduction is very short, Mark 1:1 to 1:8, where John the Baptist finally says, I have baptized you with water, and he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit. Okay? Because then verse 9 says, you know, that Jesus came on the scene, and then you have the baptism of Jesus. So you have the introduction of the main character in the main part of the book. But this went very well, this paper. And a little later in this podcast, I want to talk about some of the main, points that I made with it when we talk about the Gospel of Mark as such. So Let me just say that I'm also on a steering committee of another thing, which is biblical Greek language and linguistics, which basically considers Greek issues. So I didn't do much in that section this time because I was so heavily involved in the two Mark things, you know, giving papers and so forth. Now, I'm telling you, and your viewers and listeners should know, this is a great opportunity at SBL to be able to get our ideas out to the scholarly world. And I will tell you, Elizabeth, I will tell you that the people who come from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and now I'm speaking specifically of Concordia Seminary, where I teach as well, we can very well hold our own, especially with the original languages. We are much, much better than almost anyone because they don't take the languages as seriously as we do. Now, a lot of people don't know, maybe you don't even know this, that the chief lexicon, the chief dictionary of the New Testament, the Bauer, Danker, Arndt, Gingrich lexicon, has a joint publication situation that the copyright is owned jointly by University of Chicago Press and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has traditionally been extremely interested in what you might call the nuts and bolts of biblical interpretation. And, you know, I am just really proud to say that Concordia Seminary represents that extremely well. And it's one of the reasons I always want to be giving papers and so on. But you know,
I will say visitors to the booth, when they asked what was unique about the commentary series, and I explained that to them, I talked about how the intentionality with which our authors go to the original languages and the time that they spend, they all immediately latched onto that as something significant.
Yeah, no, that's good. And thank you for emphasizing that, because that is, that's just a huge point. It's just a huge point. You know, I'm going to say this from a slightly different point of view now. There is a difference if you're working with the Greek, like say in Mark, or your father, Dale Meyer, is working on the Concordia Commentary in 1 Peter. All right. Now, there's a difference. Now, your dad has this tremendous doctor's degree from Washington University in St. Louis. And he had that in classics, okay? So people from Concordia Seminary who present papers present the papers a little differently in a way than a lot of other people. And here's the way, Elizabeth, here's kind of the way I've decided to describe this. There's a difference between reading the Greek, or if you're doing Old Testament, reading the Hebrew, and then rendering that into English, and reading English first and then checking the Greek. Reading English first and checking the Hebrew. See, it depends upon who's driving the bus. So is the original language driving the bus, or is the English driving the bus? And you're just kind of monitoring what's going on. Well, here's why I'm bringing this up. Is when I, for example, was giving this paper on the introduction to Mark. Well, the Greek was driving the bus, see? And so people started arguing with me about my renderings of the Greek, and it didn't end well. You know, I mean, because they don't devote themselves to the study of the original languages the way we do let me put it this way. I would say that a good biblical scholar actually reading the original languages now does this in three steps, and most people are only doing it in two steps. All right, here's what most people do. They read the original, they're maybe, you know, going off the English too, and so on, and then they do the theology off of what they've done. I would say what our exegetes do, and it's certainly what I do, is there is a third prior step, which is this. You read the Greek and you consider what's going on in the Greek qua language, as a language. You know, in other words, if I were reading Xenophon or Plato or something like that, I'm actually working on the language. Then I'm doing a translation, and then I'm doing the commentary, the theology part of it. And this is, to me, this is completely noticeable when you're at SBL. I would say that the enterprise of biblical interpretation has sort of fallen on hard times because of the lack of actual attention to the details of the text. Now, your father and I have corresponded about some stuff, you know, on details of the Greek. That's just the very thing that most people aren't kind of interested in. You know, my colleagues, retired now, Paul Robbie and Andy Bartelt, worked with David Noel Friedman at the University of Michigan, and they were big guns in the Isaiah section for a long time. Well, they worked with David Noel Friedman with things like this, actually counting syllables to see how you ought to do divisions of the text and so on. That kind of devotion to the most basic textual questions is a hallmark of the Missouri Synod, and it is certainly a hallmark of Concordia Seminary St. Louis. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of talk about that a little bit because this became very, very noticeable how different my paper was on this business of the introduction than the other papers because, if I could use this phrase, I was sort of grinding the grammar, you know, in a way that you go to somebody from another school, they're not grinding the grammar like that. Anyway, that's a little view of what was going on with the Mark thing. And one last thing, and then I'll pick up your question here. It's very interesting. The people who are working with Mark now, either in the Mark Passion Narrative seminar or in the Mark section, are generally sort of literary critical people, not historical critical people. So, and this is very positive for people like us. In other words, they're taking the text and the story very seriously. They're not kind of reconstructing what they think happened as the Gospel of Mark was being composed and all the rest. The people associated with the Gospel of Mark are a lot more sensible than that.
Well, I had the opportunity to sit in on part of your session where you were presenting on the introduction. And I will say it was a full house. And I think that audience in that full room appreciated the way that you were grinding the grammar, at least based on what I was able to pick up from the back of the room. And then what you were just describing as your first step that most people forget, that makes a lot of, as I look at your volumes in the commentary, it makes sense with how you have it broken out with the linguistic essentials And so you can tell that you put the energy and the effort into how it's used and the literary effects of the original text. So it's a very cool thing to see kind of the why you do that and how, what leads to that. So No, we're looking forward to being at SBL again next year. I think it'll be a great time. And it is a wonderful opportunity for scholars from around the world to be exposed to the Concordia Commentary Series and to our academics.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you in this regard for helping us to organize just a little bit of a get together, you know, where people and also Lutherans from other bodies like the Wisconsin Synod and so on, you know, we can all meet and talk and so on like that. And that is very helpful and encouraging for them, you know, and encouraging for them. I think it's just a tremendous opportunity that I wish more people in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod would take advantage of.
So let's talk a little bit about Mark as a whole. I know you and I have talked about how Mark as a gospel is rather significant, and then it's different than the other gospels, and it's particularly useful when we are experiencing times of challenge and times of trouble. Give us a little bit of an overview of the gospel to help our listeners as they approach reading it.
Okay. Now, the thing about Mark is that it's quite different than the other two synoptics. First of all, it is noticeably shorter. But it's noticeably shorter. And that has kind of caused it to be a little bit, I don't know, what would you say, neglected, you know, in the history of the church, because there are very few pericopes or units of text stories, very few pericopes in the Gospel of Mark that don't appear anywhere else. Now, some of the viewers and listeners may be familiar with one of these pericopes toward the end, toward the middle of chapter 8, where it takes Jesus sort of two tries to heal the blind man. You know, he sees stuff indistinctly, and then Jesus gives him another shot, you know, of energy or something, and then he can see everything clearly. Now, that story does not appear anywhere else. And by the way, I might just say, Elizabeth, that story should be the gospel lesson for the feast day of St. Mark. And one of the reasons being is it is totally unique to the Gospel of Mark and has an importance in the flow of the story, you know. but Mark being a shorter gospel doesn't have as many pericopes, but, and here's something I really want the viewers and listeners to get. Mark, though, has the most detail for the individual stories. This is one thing that's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. So, you know, for example, let me just put it this way. If you think of stories that you know in the life of Jesus with the various details that they have, you're probably remembering them from the Gospel of Mark. It's very interesting the way the sheer amount of details in the story are essentially Markan. So if people are, you know, have their Bibles and are looking along, I would say they should look at Matthew 9. If they look at Matthew 9, let's just take a look here. And I'm thinking of the story of the woman with the issue of blood. Okay, now chapter 9, go to verses 20 and following. Now, this is in Matthew. This is Matthew's story of the woman with the issue of blood. All right. And behold, a woman bleeding for 12 years, having come up behind him, touched the hem of his garment, for she was saying in herself, if I only touch his cloak, I will be saved. And Jesus, turning and seeing her, said, have courage, sister, your faith has made you well. And the woman was saved from that hour. That's the whole story. What happened to the business of she's creeping up behind him, you know, that she had suffered all these years. She had spent all of her money. She crept up behind him. Jesus says, who touched me? Then the disciples say, what? Do you see the crowd around you? And you say, who touched me? And he's looking around and everything. That's all in the Gospel of Mark. See, that's all in the Gospel of Mark. So the first thing here that our viewers and listeners should realize is that Mark has way more detail per pericope, per story. And this is one of the things that has actually, how should I say this, attracted the attention of people interested in literary factors of the gospel, because Mark has way better storytelling, way better storytelling. Then Mark is a gospel that is sort of predicated, especially early on action. You get this immediately coming up all the time. And immediately Jesus did this, and immediately something or other happened. And then that immediately disappears in the middle of the gospel. And then starting with the entry into Jerusalem, the immediately picks up again. So Mark's kind of working the story like this.
Well, when you and your colleagues presented the Gospel of Mark from memory.
Yes.
I mean, the details of the story and the speed and the immediately comes through so clearly when you listen to Mark being told versus you get it when you read it. But boy, when you're hearing it, it's a whole new level of understanding of just the detail and the speed.
Yes. Now, just so the podcast people understand what you're talking about, Elizabeth is talking about the group of six of us from Concordia Seminary who, having divided this up into various ways, memorized the entire Gospel of Mark and did an oral presentation, one man at a time being on stage. Her father, Dr. Dale Meyer, was one of the ones who did material from chapter one into chapter four and so forth. And so what she's saying is, when you watch this, and we were careful, Elizabeth, to keep the immediately's in there, because some translations after a while will leave them out because they think it's repetitious and so on like that. But this was a very good point for you to bring up. Very good. Now, the last thing, one of the last things I want to say about just basic issues is Mark has this issue of the ending that we talked about. Does it end with, you know, they said nothing to anyone for they were afraid in 16:8? Or does it go on with post-resurrection stuff? Now, what's interesting about this, and here's where we get to play a little show and tell. What's interesting about this is I have a facsimile here of the most important manuscript for the New Testament, Codex Vaticanus. So this codex is in all likelihood one of the 50, now this is a copy here, okay, but the original is one of the 50 that was ordered by Constantine, the emperor, after Christianity became licit, became legal, for the new churches in Constantinople. And this manuscript contains both the New Testament and the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Now, I want to show you something here which illustrates what I'm talking about. In Codex Vaticanus, it is a three-columned manuscript. So take a look in this facsimile here. And you can see how there are three columns per page. Okay. Now I want you to notice on this page here how the Gospel of Matthew ends in that middle column. How the Gospel of Matthew ends in that middle column, and then the rest of the column is blank. And then the Gospel of Mark starts. So now I'm going to show you, and this is unique, I'm going to show you what's at the end of the Gospel of Mark. And it's this page over here. And I want you to see that the Gospel of Mark ends in the second column, about halfway down. Then the third column is blank. The third column is blank. And it is, and we're not sure why it's blank. Is it because the copyist knew there was more and refused to put it in? Or is it because he was told not to put it in, but he thought he would have an indication that it was there? But I give you that particular screenshot, that particular image here of that additional blank column, because almost no one knows about that who doesn't work with manuscripts specifically. So in other words, there is this really, really important issue of the ending of the gospel. So we can talk about that in a little bit, but I'd like to talk more about the gospel more generally. So here's the blank column right here. Notice the middle column ends halfway. That's the way it is with all the books. It ends where it ends. But no other book has a blank column like this. So, and by the way, for the people who are viewing particularly, I want you to see that actually looking at manuscripts or good facsimiles of them is different than reading the text in an edited edition like this. There's no blank column in here, see? And in fact, not only is there no blank column, Elizabeth, there's no indication of a blank column. In other words, like there's not in some footnote, and by the way, in Vaticanus, there's a blank column. You know, you don't get any kind of a thing like that. So as my former colleague and now director of the Museum of the Bible, Jeffrey Kloa, always says, is that there's no substitute for actually dealing with the actual manuscripts. And let me just say in general to the viewers and the listeners, and this will be a surprise to everybody, and that is, it isn't until 1516, when Erasmus did his so-called Novum Instrumentum, new instrument, in which he produced an edited edition of the Greek New Testament on the basis of several manuscripts, and then he did an edited text. There was no edited text in the history of the world. In other words, all there were, Elizabeth, were manuscripts. There were only individual manuscripts, and every manuscript is different. Every manuscript is different, even if it's just a little bit, but every manuscript is different. And so most people don't realize what a person's kind of dealing with when you're dealing with the text of the New Testament. Old Testament is like this too, but there are some differences. All right, so I just wanted to talk about that because that is this business of the ending is pretty important, And indeed, let me just say, it has led some people, including Keith Elliott, who I think is the foremost textual critic in the world, to suggest that the beginning of the Gospel of Mark has been lost. So in other words, people will say, well, in the manuscripts like this, the earliest ones, we don't have an ending beyond 16:8, but maybe it's been lost. You know, maybe Mark didn't want to end it there. It's been lost. And Elliot kind of has that belief where he said, you know, it's probably been lost, but maybe the beginning's been lost because it has no infancy kind of a thing. See, now I don't believe either of those, but I'm just saying for the viewers and the listeners, it's kind of an interesting issue. So let me say now a little bit, if I can, about the plot of Mark and the characters of Mark, and then we'll talk about the theme and the message and so on. Okay, is that all right? All right.
That works great.
Okay, so in the plot of Mark, there's no chronology early. So it will say in the earliest chapters, it will just say something like, and then he went, or one day he did this. So you have to realize that you get this impression right away. Mark is not trying to give a scientific account. He's sort of working the story more dramatically. Now, here's why this is important. The very first evidence we have about the Gospel of Mark is from the church father Papias, P-A-P-I-A-S, around 115 AD. And he says that Mark was the interpreter of Peter. And he says that Peter presented his materials for the needs of the people. So you immediately get the impression that if Mark is sort of reflecting what Peter did, that he's concerned with the impact of the story, you know, not just like historical details or something like this. I mean, this is Bo Ryka, who taught in University of Basel for a long time, and I did some postdoctoral work with him. He was very big on this point, that Papias says that he arranged it with reference to needs, prostas chryas, with reference to needs. So I think immediately we start looking at things beyond sort of historical account kind of stuff. All right. Secondly, in the plot, there are these things called intercalations. Intercalations. And what they are is they are ABA constructions. All right. Now, everybody knows one of them, and that is Jairus' daughter and the woman with the issue of blood. All right. So it starts out, Jairus comes to Jesus, asks for help. On the way, the woman intercepts the party. And then after Jesus deals with the woman, then he goes on and raises Jairus' daughter who has died. A, B, A prime. Now, all the synoptic gospels have this. They don't have a whole bunch of other ones that Mark does. Now, Luke, for example, will have some of the same stories, but he doesn't do the A, B, A thing. He just puts the story completely and then this story completely, like that. But let me just give you and the podcast viewers and listeners a couple of examples, okay? Probably the most striking one concerns the temple and Jesus's actions after Palm Sunday. So in Mark, he goes in verse 11, and views the temple, and then leaves. Then he curses the fig tree. And then he goes back to the temple and clears the temple. So you have temple, fig tree, temple. Temple, cursing of the fig tree, temple. Now, what you realize when Mark does this is this has a hermeneutical or interpretive impact. The middle story is the story that interprets the outer sections. So here, temple, cursing of the fig tree, temple. The temple is doomed, because the fig tree is the interpretive element in the intercalation. Okay, let me give you a couple of other ones. Chapter 14. There is the plot early on in the chapter to do away with Jesus by the leaders. Then follows the woman who anoints Jesus with oil. And what follows that is a return to the plot where Judas agrees to do it. All right? Mark has in the middle of the plot the woman who anoints him for his burial. Well, hermeneutically, what do you determine? That plot's going to succeed. See, that plot is going to succeed. Here's another one, chapter 6. Jesus sends out the 12 on a mission. Then follows immediately, verses 14 to 29, the longest pericope in which Jesus doesn't make an appearance, and that's the death of John the Baptist. Then the people, the 12, return. Mission, death of John the Baptist, mission. What is this? When you are on a mission for Jesus, there are deadly consequences that are possible. So Mark has these intercalations, and there are others, but we'll move on from that. But there is a, again, may I say, Elizabeth, this is why Mark has attracted people, interpreters, who are interested in literary factors, because there's cool stuff going on in the way the story is told. Now I want to talk about another factor in the plot, and that is the so-called messianic secret. There's a thing in Mark where Jesus keeps telling people not to tell anything about what he's doing. Or he tries to hide and not be known. For example, the Syrophoenician woman story, he's trying not to be known. Now, what's interesting about this that most people don't realize, and this is important, all of this discussion about secrecy, all of this discussion basically disappears, with one exception, after Jesus utters the first passion and resurrection prediction. So, in other words, once it's known that his end is going to be his death and then his resurrection, now, apparently, he doesn't care if everybody tells because he's going to the cross. And then another factor of the plot is the strange misunderstanding constantly by the 12. The 12 are complete boobitzes in this gospel. They're never getting anything. And
kind of like my sons when I ask them to do something.
Yes, there you go. But Jesus just hammers and hammers the disciples about their inability to understand. And, what you get with this is finally Jesus doesn't have any allies. You know, in other words, nobody's really helping him with any of this. They're not getting what's going on. He predicts they're all going to flee, and they do. And then there is the business of the ending, how open-ended it is. And I'm going to talk about that now in just a minute when I talk about the characters. I'm going to come back specifically to the ending issue, okay? So before I get on to the characters, I'm going to give one other interesting thing that's not a matter of plot, but a matter of Mark's kind of composition that nobody has actually seen, and it's described in the introduction to volume one of my commentary, okay? And that is that in the most clever way, Mark actually changes his Greek as you move through the gospel. So in the first part of the gospel, the Greek is quite Semitic. So it uses verb first, then subject word order a lot. It uses the basic word for and, chi. It uses some very basic things. The further you move through the gospel, especially when you get to chapter 8, but you can see it already in 6 and 7, because it's the worm is turning. All of a sudden, the Greek becomes more Greek-y. It becomes more Hellenic. You have more subject-verb word order, not verb-subject word order. You have the use of de rather than chi, a little fancier word. You have more complicated verb usage and so forth. So what Mark's actually able to do is when Jesus, interesting to try to describe this, when Jesus is in Galilee, Mark's narrative description is more Semitic. And the closer he moves to Jerusalem, which is a metropolitan capital where you would have like the Sadducees who were big Greco-Roman fans, the more Greek-y the Greek becomes. And so finally, when you have the story of Jesus before Pilate, it's really quite good Greek, whereas if you compare it to chapter 1 or 2 or 3, that's more Semitic Greek. Now, nobody's ever recognized this phenomenon, and I think it just shows sort of the genius of Mark's composition, which is why I spend, Elizabeth, all that time that you pointed out, you know, in the pericopes on linguistic factors and so on. I mean, this is a very, very, very well-constructed work, and I've said to many people with regard to Mark, you have to decide either that Mark was some hack stitching stuff together, or he was a fantastic literary, you know, compositionist. And you got to kind of make a decision on that. I mean, do you think Mark is really that good, or is he just kind of hacking around and, you know, stuff changes because he doesn't know what he's doing or something like that? Well, you'll notice you said you sat in for a while on my paper, and all the while I'm trying to show about all this cool stuff going on, you know, and half the people are kind of wondering whether you're making it all up. Well, this is a fundamental decision you have to make as an interpreter. Okay, so let's go on to the characters, because then that gets me onto the picture of Jesus, which is critical to what you were asking me about the use of Mark in hard times and so on. All right, first thing, and I've already mentioned this, the 12 are seen as thick and dunderheaded, all right? Not like Luke. In Luke, the 12 know all kinds of stuff that's going on. In fact, Jesus says, in connection with the Last Supper in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, you know, I am handing over the kingdom to you, and so on like that. If you're in the Gospel of Mark, nobody give those people anything, you know? Now, by contrast, the minor characters in Mark are totally critical to the story and the real examples. So who do you have? The woman with the issue of blood, Jairus, the woman who anoints Jesus for his burial, the man who brings the demon-possessed boy after the, you know, all of these minor characters are the characters that you want to emulate. So I would say, if there are any pastors listening here who are wondering about doing something like a Lenten theme, when you're in Series B, which we are now, do the minor characters of the Gospel of Mark. Not the disciples, the minor characters, because there's where you find the people whose faith has saved you, you know? Now, I mean, I will say with the disciples, as thick and dunderheaded as they are, they do stick with Jesus until the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, they kind of don't understand, but they don't abandon him throughout. And then the enemies of Jesus in this gospel are portrayed extremely negatively. I mean, early on, chapter 3, they are already plotting to kill him. Now, here's why this is important. So, they begin to plot to kill Jesus after he heals the man with the withered hand. That's in chapter 3 of Mark, 3:1-6. That same story occurs in Matthew, and they plot to kill him there too. But Matthew's story of the man with the withered hand doesn't occur till chapter 12. Well, it has a completely different effect in the book. See, Matthew has the infancy stories. It's got 3 chapters of the Sermon on the Mount, you know. It's got longer stuff about the temptation. So the literary effect of having that come so early is different in the Gospel of Mark than it is in the Gospel of Matthew. Now let's get on to Jesus, because this is where we want to focus. And there are a number of characteristics, and I mention a whole bunch of them in the introduction to volume 1 of the commentary, but I'm going to just mention 4 today. First, he is a man of great authority. So in chapter 1, the people are amazed when he, the guy with the unclean spirit, and you know, they're amazed that he can do it. And in fact, right before it, it says that he is speaking, exuding authority, and not as their scribes. And after Jesus stills the storm at the end of chapter 4, the disciples say in the last verse, verse 41, who is this that the wind and the seas obey him? So there is just something about his power and authority. And let me just say that in the Gospel of Mark, unlike any other gospel, extends to the law of Moses. He is able to simply kind of transgress the law in a way that is shocking. Now, you get this a little bit in Matthew if you're reading carefully, like Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard it said, but I say to you. But, you know, in Mark, you get this with this story of the hand washing in chapter 7. And, you know, Jesus talks about it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of a man. You know, and Jesus asked the disciples, well, don't you know that it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of a man? And then I like to put it this way, Elizabeth. And then the disciples said, no, actually, we thought that Leviticus and the laws of Moses said that what goes into a man can defile him. No, not for Jesus. See, it says declaring all foods clean. Really? Who gets to do that? Or in chapter 2, when the disciples are doing grain, your dad does a great job in the thing where he goes, the disciples are doing grain, going like this and then eating it. And so they say, why are your disciples doing what's not lawful? Well, I always point out to students, you'll notice that Jesus doesn't argue the law. He doesn't say, well, look, you don't really understand how the law works. There's this gleaning thing, you know, or something like this. No, he says, you know, David, who's talking about David? David, when he was hungry, just went in and took the showbread. And so his disciples can do this too, because the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. You know, this is the Colossus from Nazareth, who simply has control of everything. Okay, so authority. Related to authority is his power. The stilling of the storm. The walking on the water. And yet, Elizabeth, he is ignorant of who touched his garment. He is weak. They take him captive. He doesn't do anything. He can't seem to get the disciples to understand what he's doing and everything like this. And this leads me to the third point. In Mark's gospel, Jesus is portrayed as this pretty odd person. So, for example, when he heals the leper in chapter 1, verses 40 and following, he then berates the guy and throws him out. Well, what the heck is with that, you know? In 133, he wants to keep his identity secret, even though he's going out to preach everywhere, but then he tries to get away from people. In chapter 6, it's one of my favorite things. Jesus walking on the water. How different from Matthew, walking on the water. And it says, and he was intending to pass them by. What the heck is that about? Was he kind of sneaking around there with them? Or how about in chapter 11 that I mentioned, the cursing of the fig tree? And Mark says, it wasn't the time for figs. Well, why are you cursing the fig tree for not having figs if it's not the time for figs? So Jesus is this sort of odd guy doing all kinds of stuff that you would never expect. And let me put it this way. So now with his authority and power and odd behavior and ignorance and weakness, you get this ambiguous picture of Jesus. That's one of the key things in the gospel, the ambiguous picture of Jesus. So now we're homing in on your question about the importance of the gospel. So I'm going to take one more step before I get to that, and that is that in this gospel, Jesus's word is ever sure. So 8:31, 9:31, 10:33, and 4, he gives the three passion and resurrection predictions, and everything he says comes true. In chapter 11, he says there will be a donkey tied, and the disciples go, and it's true. In chapter 14, he says that there is, verse 13, that there is a man who's going to meet them carrying a water jar, and he's going to take them to a place that is going to be where they have the Passover. And that's true too. And then later in chapter 14, he says that one of the 12 is going to betray him. he says that he is then going to go before them into Galilee after he is raised. And he says to Peter that he will deny him three times. And every one of those things comes true. And this is why the most important verse, and I say this very strongly to all podcast viewers and listeners, most important verse in the Gospel of Mark is 16:7, where the young man at the tomb says, he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. That's the key. Just as he told you. So this gospel is about the absolute surety of the word of and the promises of Jesus in the face of ambiguity, ambiguous evidence, and things that just don't seem right. So let me end what we're talking about with this now. And I'm reading basically from a couple of places from the introduction to the commentary in volume one. But let me just read here. The theme of Mark's narrative. What is the story about? Consider the details. When we read this gospel with these features in bold relief, what do we come to understand? We see Jesus as the one who walks upon and leads his disciples in the way of the cross. We see Jesus triumphing in and through suffering and the cross, saving his life by losing it. But this is not the main theme of the gospel. That's a penultimate theme. When you read this gospel, you see a different, a stranger, and more fascinating picture, a story of ambiguity. The protagonist is divine. He casts out demons. He raises the dead. He walks on water. But he is a frail human being who gets angry when his opponents resist, ignorant of his garments being touched. He cannot do miracles when people don't believe in his hometown, chapter 6. And he is a scary and strange guy who hides from the crowd, who dresses down a man whom he has healed, and who curses a fig tree when it's not the season for figs. And the plot is ambiguous. The voice declares from heaven, "You are my beloved son." He does miracles. He reveals the kingdom. Yet his relatives in chapter 3 think he's crazy. The disciples wonder, who is this that the winds and the seas obey him? So now, simply and succinctly put, in the second gospel, we see a story hard to follow and a hero difficult to understand. Therefore, we cannot see clearly and believe, or as summarized by the Jewish leaders at the cross, 15:32. And this is what they say, "The Christ, the King of Israel, let him come down now from the cross, hina idomen kai pistoisomen, in order that we may see and believe." And Elizabeth, this is precisely what this gospel will not give you. Seeing to believe, clear sight to understand the ambiguous evidence. In this strange and perplexing gospel, seeing is not believing. On the contrary, seeing follows from the believing, not the other way around. And what is it that you're supposed to believe? It is the word of him who came to bring the reign and rule of God from the end time into this life. The word of him whose promises in this story are true and ever sure. This then is what the gospel is about. The ambiguity of the evidence, the necessity of believing in the face of that ambiguity, and the reliability of Jesus's word. So my view is that this gospel, and Papias says this, Irenaeus says this in 180, is written to the people in Rome. And I'm thinking of it like this. Peter was there, early 60s, persecution is starting, and the people are there, and they're thinking, well, we want to be faithful Christians. We want to follow our Lord. You know, we want to trust him. If only we could have been there. If only we could have been in the shoes of the disciples. If only we could have seen. And the answer to this gospel is no. It was no different. The evidence was always ambiguous. You are in no different position than the early disciples. And by the way, that's why it ends at 16:8 without a citing of the resurrected Jesus. That's what you have. You don't have a citing of the resurrected Jesus. Just like the disciples, they had to believe the word and go to Galilee. We know they did. We have to believe the word. And let me end this, Elizabeth, by saying the following. I have told my wife that if I die first, I want you to put this on my tombstone. I'm serious about this. ... Just as he told you. Mark 16:7. And everybody who sees that tombstone can go look it up.
It's powerful.
This is the most powerful gospel.
Absolutely. And I think for our listeners and viewers who in the coming weeks on Sundays, if your congregation follows the lectionary readings, you will be hearing from Mark. And so this context and this perspective, I think, helps provide a richer understanding as we encounter these texts in the coming weeks and months of this church year. So I appreciate your taking the time to really dive deep into this for us to help us understand the Gospel of Mark a little bit more clearly.
Good. No, I'm happy to be able to do this. This is, it's been a great, great privilege to work on the Gospel of Mark because you get to encounter the promise on a daily basis.
Absolutely. For our listeners and viewers, we will link to Dr. Veltz's commentaries in the show notes. So if you want to dive a little deeper, you can go check out those links and check out those commentaries. Dr. Veltz, always good to see you and always good to learn from you. And so thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Listeners, till next time. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Concordia Publishing House podcast. I pray that this time was valuable to your walk with Christ. We'd love to connect with listeners on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Concordia Pub. Visit cph.org for more resources to grow deeper in the gospel.